I'll call to order the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. Colleagues, today is March 14th, 2011, and we are convened for the purposes of a public hearing and possible work session for Senate Bill 41, Senate Bill 668, and then we will have a work session on Senate Bill 751 for the purposes of re-referring this back to the President's desk. What I thought I would do, since there are a number of people here that came from considerable distances on both bills, actually, but what the prerogative of the chair will be is to allow the Attorney General to present his testimony on Senate Bill 41 first, and then we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 41, jump into Senate Bill 668, and then after we conclude the testimony on 668, we will come back to Senate Bill 41 and continue.
Mr. Chair, if people have traveled far to testify on the other bill, I'm happy to wait and let them go first. I blocked out the time.
Okay. If that's okay with you?
Absolutely.
So then we'll just go ahead and jump into Senate Bill 668. That's going to take a little while if you need to attend to other business. Okay, so I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 668. Could we please bring up Mike Kelly, Jeff Boardman, and then Ted Fitzgerald we will do by telephone. On deck after that will be Kurt Melcher from ODF&W, Greg Peden, and Craig Yurdis. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chairman Shields, committee members, first of all, thank you very much for your time and attention today. My name is Mike Kelly, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 668. I believe it to be very significant and much-needed legislation.
Mike, I apologize. Let me interrupt you briefly. I forgot that Representative Krieger was here, and so I would like to bring Representative Krieger up to make some introductory comments, if you wouldn't mind.
Certainly yield the floor.
Representative Krieger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1. I did think that you had forgotten me.
Sorry.
Even though we talked out in the hall. Senate Bill 668 has come about as a result of what I observed during my career at the Oregon State Police days towards the end and forward regarding commercial fishing businesses on the Oregon coast. Most of you know I spent 28 years on the Oregon coast enforcing the fish and wildlife laws and commercial fishing laws, and most of that was spent on the south coast. And I would say that probably nearly half of my time dealt with the fishing, commercial fishing industry. At one time on the coast, back starting in 64, that's when I got there, nearly every port had anywhere from one to three buyers. Some had as many as eight or nine. And then also we had a situation where there were actually seasonal people that came in during the peak of some of those seasons. And also at one time there were virtually no limited entry permits. The fishermen just bought a license and fished in whatever fishery that they wanted. And this really began to change in the 70s with limited entry permits for the federal fisheries offshore and mostly in groundfish, whiting, and there were a few others. The state of Oregon developed limited entry permits for shrimp, crab, salmon, live fish, and the nearshore fisheries. Actually, the nearshore fishery was done, I think, in 2003, which was 3108, was the bill that I sponsored. These permits were put in place to stop the growth and overcapital investment beyond capacity and provide sustainable fisheries. Those permits were supposed to provide sustainability for the resource so we didn't overfish. It would always be there for the fishermen, the processors, and the communities that depended on them. I think this is key for you to understand. So I'll repeat it. The permits were supposed to provide sustainability for the fishermen, the resource itself, the processors, and the communities. But like most places where profit can be made, there are those who desire to grow, control, buy out, and force out competition. This situation has grown worse in the past 15 years than it ever had in all those years that I had with the department during those earlier years. And historically, there were a few fishermen that would have one or two boats, and there were a few that had three of various sizes, and they took part in varied fisheries depending on what type of equipment they needed. And there were fishermen who often also would have buyer's license or dealer's license. Normally it was a seasonal type thing, or if they had a restaurant that they were also catching their own fish for. Today there's one operator that has somewhere between 10 and 13 boats. I'm not certain yet. We can't get accurate information. And he controls about 80% of the shrimp picking machines here in Oregon. He buys a high percentage of the Dungeness crab. He has bought out numerous companies and buying stations to reduce competition. Some of these he has just closed so no one else can have dock space. You may hear about unfair and probably illegal practices today. Fishermen will speak of the kinds of practices some of them have experienced. Dozens would like to tell you their experiences but are afraid to come forward. And I've talked to many of those people all the way from Brookings clear up to Astoria. Times have been tough in the commercial fishing industry. Groundfish buyback, closed ocean seasons, which caused disasters to be declared in 2006 and 2008. These season shutdowns affected not only the commercial fish family, but also the entire communities that are dependent upon them. The bill will need to be amended so it doesn't include the salmon fisheries and also the Columbia gravel net fisheries. It is time for Oregon to limit the number of permits an individual or group of companies controlled by that individual or in which that individual has a significant interest, the number of permits that that person could have. Thank you.
Any questions for Representative Krieger?
Yep. Thank you, Senator Shields. As I was saying, my name is Mike Kelly, and again, I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 668. I do believe that this is a very significant and much-needed legislation, and I think it is needed right now. It's needed to reinstate fairness, balance, a level playing field for the Oregon fishermen. When I, for full disclosure purposes, while I'm introducing myself, I also want to tell the committee that I am also one of the attorneys who is representing fishermen currently in an antitrust action against Pacific Seafood, Frank Dulcich, and about approximately 60 other Pacific-related entities up and down the West Coast. And I mentioned that at the beginning because I hope to make it clear that these are two separate and distinct matters. There is ongoing antitrust litigation, and there is this legislation. The litigation did not drive this legislation, nor vice versa. The outcome of the litigation or the legislation will not affect the other. So to the extent that there's any confusion at all that these two are tied at the hip, I hope that they're, by explaining that no one on the litigation team had anything to do with the concept of this bill, nor the drafting of it. In fact, Representative Krieger, sessions ago, submitted this bill long before there ever was an antitrust action. And while we're talking about confusion, I also hope that there's no confusion about what this bill actually would mean to private business. This is not on the books because anyone is too big or anyone is too successful. This is not anti-big business or anti-business in any respect. This bill is pro-competitive. It is pro-small business. It's pro-Oregon. And when I'm talking about the effect on business, if I could, I'd like to make two points. First of all, I don't believe this bill is asking or requiring anyone in the legislature or anyone else to stick their nose into some private business where it doesn't belong. We're not talking about the manufacturing of widgets out somewhere throughout the state. We're talking about natural resources. We're talking about Oregon's fish and Oregon fishermen getting paid a fair price for those fish. And in terms of legislation, committee members, I'd like to remind you that it is not unusual when you're talking about natural resources for governments to step in and make sure that there is not excess consolidation or ownership of a particular species. The federal guidelines were just finalized last October that limited the amount of consolidation and ownership that any one entity or any controlled by any one entity as it relates to groundfish or whiting. So there is precedent for this. It is important, and it would result, again, in Oregon fishermen receiving a fair price for the fish they catch here. The second point I'd like to make is this legislation would not change any legitimate means that any processor right now, big or small, would have. Nothing changes about their operations. Every processor, Pacific included, could buy as much seafood as they wanted. They could process as much where they wanted. They could market and sell that seafood. All this legislation would do is try to ensure that no one entity, no one person, no one series of controlled entities has sufficient power and control to set an artificially low price without meaningful negotiation. That's what this is about. And the question will come up, and I'm sure a specific question, how is it when there are so many permits out there, how will the limitation of these to three, how will that affect what you're talking about in terms of setting a fair price? And I'm going to defer to people that are actually in the industry in a moment, but I will tell you that the question isn't actually what percentage of the permits does any one processor have, because I'm sure you'll specifically hear that the largest holder of permits only has 7 crab permits of over 400, has 10 pink shrimp permits out of the approximately 40 to 50 that have been utilized over the last several years. And they'll ask, how with that small percentage can we possibly affect the price, as you're saying? The question is interesting, but if it's carefully analyzed, you'll realize that's the wrong question. The question isn't about the percentage of the permits you own. It's the percentage of control you get through those permits. And again, as will be explained in detail by some of the people actually in the industry, the problem is this. If a processor who has multiple permits and large vessels that are company-owned, what can happen is, use shrimp for an example. A price is set for shrimp. Even if the rest of the fleet does not agree that the price is fair, equitable, and reasonable based on market conditions, if one processor has the ability to put permits on large vessels and send them out to fish, while everybody else, the non-company, the independents, have to sit and watch, it puts them in a position where either one, they just have to watch the company ships go in and out with that catch, or two, they have to start fishing and paying and selling it for a price they don't believe is reasonable. And again, any confusion about how a company with multiple permits and processing facilities can influence this, I think, is taken care of when you listen to the people that testify that are involved in the industry, both fishermen, executive directors of trawling committees, managers from port facilities, etc. Thank you.
Mr. Kelly. Mr. Boardman, and then we'll have questions for the committee if you have them.
Good afternoon. This is my first time ever testifying here in Salem, but I hope you bear with me. My name is Jeff Boardman. I've been a shrimp fisherman in Newport since 1979. I own and operate the fishing vessel Miss Yvonne. I purchased that vessel in 1986 and been operating it ever since myself. I have been a member of the Shrimp Producers Marketing Cooperative since that time, which is an organization that it allows us to come together, discuss prices legally among all the fishermen. And in 2000 and 2004, I was the president of that group. And really, the only reason I'm not the president today is because it became more difficult as time went along, as Pacific got bigger. They didn't want to talk with somebody that wasn't fishing with them. So we decided to let somebody that actually fished for the company be the president of that group. I employ 3 people on my vessel, and I'm proud to be a family wage job in the fishing industry in Oregon for the last 25 years. Oregon shrimp fishermen have been the leader in developing gear in that fishery over the last 10 years. That Oregon should be proud that we were the first trawl shrimp fishery in the world that ever achieved sustainability from the Marine Stewardship Council, and we achieved that in 2007. And the way we did that was the research that we did. We created a grate that we put in our net, which is called a bycatch reduction device. We had some pressure from the Pacific Fishery Management Council to try to eliminate rockfish out of our catch. And in a 2-year period, we developed that with the help of the ODF&W. It was a great relationship, and we have ongoing research to this day. And in fact, last November, I went and testified in front of the Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission to have those great spaces, which were regulations, were at 2.5 inches. We have taken those great spaces down to 3/4 of an inch to only allow pink shrimp to go through those grates, which makes us about 99% clean in that fishery. And we hope by doing that, we go through a five-year review period with the Marine Stewardship Council, and we hope to be able to keep that status for Oregon. I am fortunate that over the last 20 years, I have no mortgage on my boat because it's been increasingly difficult to make a living in this fishery. And although wholesale prices have been rising since 2006, ex-vessel prices have been declining or been on an equal level for that period of time. And I strongly believe that the fault of this is disconnect between wholesale prices and ex-vessel prices is a consolidation of Pacific Seafood, not only on the processing side, but on the permit side and how many boats that they own. It's been more difficult to negotiate a price. I don't know if you have a chart. Do you have the chart that shows ex-vessel prices and wholesale prices for the shrimp fishery? On that chart, you will see where ex-vessel prices have stayed well below 50 cents on that chart, while since 2006, which is really the period of time that Pacific has been consolidating their fleet, you see as wholesale prices have gone up and ex-vessel prices have stayed virtually flat. And where we got those ex-vessel prices are provided through the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The wholesale prices are come from a leader in the industry in tracking wholesale prices called Ernenberry. And we know that these trends, we use the Canadian Borealis pink shrimp because that was the only information that was available at the time. But Jordan Eye pink shrimp that we catch here in Oregon competes on the same market, and we know that those prices are pretty much the same. And you ask, how does Pacific dictate ex-vessel prices? And, you know, the real reason is after obtaining over 70% of the processing capabilities along the West Coast and in many cases shutting down, you know, half of the ones that they bought to where they really only have one processing plant in each port, where we used to have, you know, three or four processing plants in each port, we're really down to one in most cases, except for in Newport, we have three. But we really only have one processing plant. The other docks are just mainly unloading facilities, and the product gets trucked out of there to a different port with Hallmark and with Ornstein Seafood. Each year, since about 2005, the state passed a law where fishermen, a group of fishermen, could get together with processors in a negotiation to try to negotiate a fair and price for the shrimp fleet. During that period of time, the only time that we actually came to an agreement was in 2008, and that's the year that we got the 50 cents. It's become more and more difficult to get a price at these meetings because Pacific has gotten bigger and stronger, and they actually have a boat out of Brookings, captained by Randy Winburn, and it seems like in the middle of negotiations that boat tends to leave port and set a price for Pacific, which puts all the other fishermen, not only the fishermen, but the other processors, in a bind, because the other processors are afraid that if they don't have any shrimp and Pacific has the only shrimp, that they'll be taking their market. So immediately we get phone calls saying, hey, we need you guys on the ocean. We need shrimp. We need to be able to compete in this market, no matter what the price is. And often those prices that Pacific offers that boat to go fishing are far below the negotiating prices that we're trying to get at those negotiations with the Department of Ag. And so you can see how that puts us in a bind immediately, and the other processors. I want to let you know that I'm definitely here, and obviously you know that I'm here to support the 668 bill. It really important for the future and the health of the Oregon pink fishery here in Oregon. And like Mike said, these guidelines are no different than what the federal government has also done with halibut, with black cod, to make sure that one person couldn't come in and buy up a majority of that product. And So you can see that the bind that we're actually in. And not to mention that, you know, we're fishing for prices that are probably 33% below what we should be fishing for. Last year we fished for 35 cents, and we figure we should be getting another dime or 15 cents more. That's 30% of your income. And not only that, you got to look at, not to mention that the taxes that are lost in landing taxes to the state on that money as well. And being the state's in a bind with tax money right now, you can see, you know, an additional 3% on every $3 to $5 million that we're missing out on landings to the boat owners and to the community. So I think it's important to note that there's a lot of money being missed out on here by all sides. And I also wanted to, I'm not here to pick on Pacific or anybody else. The way the laws are drawn up now, any one entity from anywhere in the world, I don't care if it was Japan, China, wherever, could come in, they had enough money to purchase this entire industry. And I don't think that that's what Oregon wants. I mean, Oregon should be proud of this industry. We've done a lot to make it better. You've probably seen some of it in the papers over the last couple of years. And it's time for Salem. I think there's a real disconnect. I don't want to, you know, upset anybody, but every time I come here, there's a lot of people don't really even know what's going on in the industry on the Oregon coast and the fishing industry. And it's time for Salem to take a step forward and make sure that this industry is here to stand and that the fishermen have a better opportunity to negotiate a price with the processors. Thank you.
And Mr. Board, may I have questions for this panel? Senator George.
What I understand is that it doesn't seem like the processing of this product is incredibly complex, and there's other processors. So if you're starting to see a huge differential between the dock price and the wholesale price that your chart right here shows us,
mm-hmm.
why wouldn't other processors step in and, in essence, say, hey, we'll pay you 10 cents more to get the market share? And it seems like to me, in reading on this, the demand is China. So you could quick freeze it, you could put in a tunnel, quick freeze it and get it to China and be able to capture that margin yourself. And if you guys are part of a cooperative, it seems like you guys would be able to put in a facility, process it, and take advantage of that additional market share. And the bigger the margin gets between your price and the price in China, that you would be able to take advantage of that and capitalize on that.
That's a wonderful thought, but this has been tried in the past where fishermen got together and actually tried to process some of their own product to only be beat down by the other processors. I mean, there's a... In the first place, if I wanted to be a processor, I'd be a processor. I'm a fisherman, and I enjoy fishing, and I enjoy catching shrimp and all fish on the ocean. And our main market isn't China. For the 30 years I've been in it, 25 of those years, the market's been all domestic right here on the West Coast. There are some markets opening up in Europe, which some of the product is starting to go there, which is actually help opening up some additional areas for some of the other processors that sell shrimp here on the West Coast. So, no, the market is not China. Even though they're trying to get some there, it'll probably be going there whole. It's really not a viable option for fishermen to try to pull it and start their own fish plant. We'll be beat down. We will lose money.
Senator George.
What I'm trying to get at is that if there's a bigger and bigger differential between wholesale price and price paid to fishermen, that margin gives, there's this huge motivation for competitors to move in, additional competitors to move in. And I'm trying to understand. Like I can understand you keep, it's anecdotal, but I'm trying to understand sort of the mathematics of it. There are other people who are in the business. Why wouldn't they be able to take advantage of gaining market share in this situation?
Other processors in the
right.
industry?
Just not, even if it's not a cooperative with other...
Right. We mainly have four processors. We really only have three in Oregon. Pierre is actually in the state of Washington in the Columbia River. So we have three that have survived this... Basically, I would call an attack by Pacific to draw the take the market down, force people out of business, shut those plants down, never to open those docks back up, and have a larger percentage of the overall processing capacity. And for somebody to try to step in and take any piece of that is not going to happen on the processing side. Well, I'm not so worried about the processing side. I'm worried about the permit side and how many permits any one person could own, because those 10 permits that he owns in Oregon could catch nearly 100% of the available product for that year.
Okay. Senator, if I could, there are also additional barriers to someone else coming in. I mean, there's obviously the expense. There's also the fact that a lot of the prime real estate on the up and down the coast has already been either by purchase or by lease taken over and shuttered. And to your point, I think what would open up the ability for this competition to come in is what's at the core of this bill itself, and that is to allow no one existing entity to have so many permits, but to have those permits out in the hands of multiple parties. That would attract the type of competition I believe you're talking about that would come in and start to compete on the processor end up and down the coast.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We're going to get Ted Fitzgerald on the phone. Mr. Fitzgerald, hi. This is Chip Shields, State Senator, calling from Salem. You are live in the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee, and we would like to hear your testimony on Senate Bill 668.
All right. Thank you very much. I prepared a little something. I'll just read it, if that's okay.
That would be fine. If you could do your best to summarize it, because we do have a lot of people that...
It'll be short.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, my name's Ted Fitzgerald. I've been the manager of the Port of Brooklyn Harbor since 2008. I plan to appear in person today, but the tsunami last Friday caused more damage in Brookings than any other location on the Oregon coast. We lost about 70% of our commercial docks, and I couldn't come up because I got to stay here and direct cleanup and try to secure disaster relief funds. I hope that everyone up there will help me because it is a disaster. The Port of Brooklyn Harbor is affected potentially greatly by Senate Bill 668. It's vitally important that the state of Oregon manages public resources in order to promote the greatest good for all citizens. When it comes to managing crab and shrimp resources in Oregon waters, the state needs to pursue a path that avoids consolidation and promotes healthy competition. Historically, the fishing industry has been vital to Brookings and Oregon's south coast. 10 years ago, we had 3 processors in Brookings alone. Now we have none. Eureka Fish Company facilities closed in 2001, signifying the end of processing in this part of Oregon. Pacific Seafood did not help the local situation with the port abandoned. In 1999, the company acquired SMS Seafood and the 99-year lease that included an obligation to operate a seafood processing plant. Pacific Seafood ignored that obligation, shut the plant down, and ignored the port's demands for 9 years to live up to its processing commitment. The port finally had to sue to terminate the lease, and rather than face years of costly litigation, agreed in a mediation last year to pay $350,000, which they could still afford, to terminate the lease in order to secure the return of that waterfront property to the port so that it could be redeveloped for the benefit of the community. That was the nearest processor in Oregon to Brookings, and those kinds of blows we feel directly. A great many jobs left Brookings with the shutdown of our seafood processing plants. Pacific Seafood has a landing station in Brookings, but how they use it illustrates an abuse of market power in the shrimp fishery. Let me explain. The fishing vessel that Pacific Seafood uses to set the shrimp price in recent years is the Miss Pacific, which is home ported here in Brookings. Not only does this vessel set the shrimp price in April by going out at the beginning of the season at a price set by its owner, but it is virtually the only fishing vessel allowed to deliver shrimp to the Pacific Seafood Landing Station in Brookings. And Oregon shrimp are all generally right off of Brookings, at least at any volume. By refusing to do business in a serious way with any other independent shrimpers in Brookings, Pacific Seafood completely monopolizes the shrimping grounds tributary to our own port, for its exclusive benefit and to the detriment of our local fishermen and our community. It is only with the combination of being both the dominant shrimp processor on the West Coast and owning its own fleet and the permits to assign to these vessels that Pacific Seafood can accomplish this. The pink shrimp and Dungeness crab in Oregon waters are a public resource. No firm should be able to monopolize them and use its power to drive ex-vessel prices down below the levels that would prevail in a freely competitive market. I understand that information has come out in the pending antitrust case that Pacific Seafood's fleet of fishing vessels has lost money in each of the last 5 years. If their own fleet, with the advantages they receive in terms of delivery opportunities, is losing money, what does that say about the ex-vessel prices being paid to fishermen here in my port, independent fishermen trying to make it? It's no wonder that the level of maintenance within the entire West Coast fleet is at such low levels. I see this every day in my own commercial moorage. Our commercial fishermen, who are small businesses, are struggling at the prices that they are being paid for their fish. There is no question that processors owning too many permits in a specific fishery is a big part of the problem. In my opinion, no person or company should be allowed to accumulate more than 3 permits in a given fishery. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Fitzgerald. I know that I speak for the whole committee when I say our thoughts are with you at this very, very difficult time. Is there any questions from the committee for this witness? All right, thank you. We'll let you get back to work. Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald.
I'll get back in the water. Thanks.
All right. Can we now bring up Kurt Melcher from ODF&W, Greg Peden, and Craig Ernest. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Thank you, Chair Shields. For the record, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to come here and provide some brief comments on Senate Bill 668. We did sign up to testify, and I did want to make the record clear that we signed up as a neutral entity on this bill. And we're providing some written comments as well. I'll go over and highlight those briefly and then also offer to answer any questions that you all may have with regard to our commercial permit system or any other matter. So as was mentioned earlier, this bill would essentially limit any single entity from holding more than 3 limited entry commercial fishing permits. There is a provision that would allow for some ability to transfer those permits away prior to December 31, 2013. From our perspective, there's a number of ways that we could implement this bill if passed. Certainly the most aggressive form of implementation would involve our staff having to research each of our 2,200 limited entry permit holders and or individual permits to determine ownership issues. Many times they're not, they're fairly opaque with regard to multiple business entities, corporations, sometimes even out-of-state corporations. So it would involve a significant amount of resources to do those investigations and determine ownership patterns. I think we heard Representative Krieger allude to the fact that in his work it was difficult to figure out who owned what and what all the business relationships may be among 2,200 limited entry permits. So the most aggressive implementation would require some additional resources and some staff full-time equivalents in the beginning. Then additionally, I did want to point out that our licensing staff processes between 300 and 400 permit transfers per year. Many of these permits have very specific transfer requirements, both in terms of landing, so there has to be some records of landings in a time frame. Also, there's vessel size limits that apply to many of these permits. So our staff does a significant amount of work with each of the 300 to 400 permit transfers that occur annually. Most difficult for us would be the issue of relatives in investigating to find out who are related and where we have issues of ownership by no more than 3 by individual relatives in a family group would certainly be difficult.
A lower cost implementation alternative, however, would be that we could develop an affidavit, do a mailing to all of our permit holders that details the new requirements if this bill is passed, and then at each renewal annually or at any transfer, we could have individuals sign an affidavit that says they understand the terms of the law, which would then ultimately become an enforcement issue. So if they did not come clean, I guess, if you will, on those affidavits, they would be subject to permit forfeiture or some other penalty. With that, I know you have a long list here. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions. Senator George.
A few minutes ago, we heard testimony that somebody with just a few permits could, in essence, take 100% of the catch. Did I misunderstand that, or is that correct? How does these permits work with the total available catch?
Chair Shields, Senator George. So I think the individuals were discussing the pink shrimp fishery. In Oregon, we have, I believe it's 138 pink shrimp limited entry permits. Those were, of course, created in statute. The legislature created a system and grandfathered in individuals who had participated in the fishery prior to some control date, which I don't have memorized off the top of my head. But there's 138 pink shrimp permits. Annually, we have about 50 of those permits are active. So many vessels have multiple permits on each vessel. They may or may not participate in a fishery in any given year based on their own business decisions, market considerations, whatever they may be. So in the course of a fishing year, we have about right now actively about 50 vessels that participate. They catch, they harvest the, and I again, serving, if memory serves me, the 15 to 30 million pounds annually. I think what the, and I don't want to put words into somebody else's mouth, I think what he was alluding to was that if 50 vessels are catching those fish, certainly it's plausible that, 10 vessels could do the same thing if the other vessels were not active for some market reason.
So do you guys set a catch target at ODF&W, like 20 million pounds,
sure,
and then all 50 of the permitted people can go out and to when you hit the 20 million pounds, then the season's over?
Chair Shields, Senator George, in the case of pink shrimp, like Dungeness crab, we do not set annual harvest limits. We use other regulatory means. So in the case of shrimp, it's generally size. The fishermen are able to harvest whatever total catch they can catch in the course of the year with minimum size limits. So, and it's basically done on a count. So they have to average a certain count in their deliveries.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Greg Peden. I'm here today representing Pacific Seafood Group. Pacific strongly opposes Senate Bill 668 for several reasons. But first, let me give you a little bit of history about who Pacific Seafood is. As you may know, Pacific is a third-generation, family-owned Oregon business. Pacific started when Dominic Dulcich started selling fish out of the trunk of his car on Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland in the 1940s. In fact, they still own a small retail store on Powell today. Today they have over 2,000 employees and are a vertically integrated company with facilities up and down the Oregon coast. Just last month, Oregon State University, through its Austin Entrepreneurial Program, honored several noted Oregonians for their entrepreneurial spirit and business leadership in this state. Among those honored were Junkie Yoshida, who I think a lot of you know, Jack Smith, the creator of Hotmail, the first web-based email system, and Frank Dulcich, the CEO and owner of Pacific Seafood. What seemed to me very strange that as a state we're here today debating the merits of a legislation that would take apart a company that Frank has built at the same time that Oregon State University is honoring him with one of their highest awards. One of the things I want to draw your attention to about Pacific is the article that was in the paper last week regarding Dungeness crab. Forward this to you. I hope you have had a chance to read this, but the essence of it is this. The price of crab is going up, and going up significantly, in part because the crab industry, including Pacific Seafood, has figured out a way to get crab into the Chinese markets. Not a simple task, and not without considerable risk and cost to Pacific. But as the article clearly states, they figured it out. The crab market is booming. Fishermen are making more money. And overall, it's a great thing for Oregon coast, the Oregon fishing industry, and Oregon as a whole. Now, more specifically to the bill. This is a tough one for me, because this bill is targeted at one person. And despite what the trial attorneys may have said to you earlier today, there's no way that this legislation isn't tied to that lawsuit. In fact, I think that the evidence that you've heard today sounded to me a lot like a trial. So let me give you some of our facts. As Kurt just mentioned, there are roughly 2,200 available fishery permits in Oregon. Pacific Seafood and its related entities owns 19 of those permits.
21.
That's roughly 1%. So to the allegation of market manipulation, monopolies, and other such language today, 1% is what Pacific owns in fishery permits. Hardly a monopolistic number, hardly a market manipulation number, hardly a number at all. Another point that was brought up, the idea or the concept that Pacific could, and this is important, one of the testimonies earlier today was that they could hold all other fishery boats in the harbor while they were negotiating a price and then send out their boats to capture all of the catch. Members of the committee, this has never happened. This is an allegation by the proponents of this bill saying that Pacific could take such action. Seems hard-pressed to me that we would pass legislation on something that could happen that in the history of the fishery has not. Two more points. One, the bill sets the permit limit at 3. Based on what? It's an extremely arbitrary number. There's no standard set for this. There's no comparative level of what would be a threshold or why we would hit 3 versus 5 or 10 or a percentage. Just picks 3. Second half of the piece of legislation personally identifies anybody who would fit this category. A processor who owns more than 3 permits could not pass such business assets onto their heirs. Again, that's a very personal piece of legislation that affects, to my knowledge, one person in this state. Hardly appropriate language, in my opinion, for a piece of legislation based on unfounded data. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, you said that the Pacific owns 1% of the total licenses. What percent of, and I just learned, because I'm learning a lot here, that there's something called the pink shrimp license. And so what percent of the pink permits do they hold?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, approximately 6%.
Thank you.
10%.
I've got pink shrimp at 9.6.
Mr. Ernest?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Craig Ernest. I'm the general counsel for Pacific Seafood Group. Obviously, we oppose this bill. You've heard some testimony to this committee today that was, in my opinion, presented as fact, but in fact it is opinion, and candidly opinions held by a small group of fishermen primarily located in southwest Oregon. We are in the middle of an antitrust litigation, one of the goals of which, should plaintiffs prevail, would be to break Pacific Seafood apart. This bill is very personal to Pacific Seafood. I think that the earlier testimony clearly reflects that, and I think it would be appropriate for this committee to not pass this bill out, and more importantly, let the people that are litigating that think we're too big take care of it in the courtroom. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen. All right. Let's bring up Emily Dunn, Steve Bodner, and Mike Haglin. And we'll do Emily Dunn, then we'll call Duras Peak. And we have a lot of the written testimony, so if you could, because I do want to be on to the next bill by, say, 2 o'clock, if we could do our best to employ concision, I sure would appreciate it. So if you could summarize your remarks as opposed to reading them.
My name is Emily Dunn, and I've been fishing commercially for Dungeness crab for over 26 years on this coast. And since 2003, my husband Eddie and I, we've fished out of Garibaldi, mostly for Dungeness crab. My family and our crew are paid on a percentage of the catch, depend for our livelihoods on the ex-vessel prices in our Dungeness crab market. Unfortunately, during the last 5 years, it's become harder and harder to make a living because our price, as you can see by the graph that we have here, is basically flatlined and stayed the same. And all of us know what's happened to our fuel prices, especially in the last few years. And it's becoming harder and harder to make a living at this. And we've watched Pat Seafood market share rise tremendously. Even in our port, they now buy most of the crab, quite a large percentage of the crab that goes through our port. We now have two buyers instead of three in port, and Pat Seafood buys more crab than our other buyer there. And we know they have over 50% of the market for crab now. And what happens when these people have these permits and they're able to put them on the boats, it doesn't matter whether it's PAC, some other processor, or whoever, when they have too many of their own boats, they're able to dictate the price. We've lost our price negotiations here. We don't have nearly the ability to negotiate prices. This last year, they wanted, you know, some of the processors at the meetings, they wanted to pay more than the $1.75 a pound that we got paid to start with last year. And Pacific said no. Quite a few years in the past, probably the last 3 or 4 years, I've asked a buyer in our town, what does it look like we're going to get for crab this year for a price? And I'm told the same thing. We have to wait and see what Frank Dulcich wants to pay. And this year, we ended up $1.67.5 per pound for crab, which is less than $1.75 a pound that we started with last year. And do you know what's crazy? It's the first time ever in our history that we've ever gotten a half a cent in our price. A half a cent? They couldn't make it $1.68. They had to get it down to $1.67.5. And during the price negotiations, it was decided that gear would be set on the 10th of December and no crab would be delivered until the 12th. If crab was delivered before the 12th of December, we'd get $1.65 a pound for our crab, not $1.67.5. Pat's buyer in the port of Garibaldi told us that we could sell on the 11th for the $1.67.5 per pound for crab. And I said, well, how's that? According to the agreement, if we sell before the 12th, we're going to get $1.65 to start for the season. And I was told, no, that only has to do with the association boats. That agreement is only between the association boats and the buyers, that they could buy from non-association boats before then and pay the $1.67.5. So my husband and I, we sold crab to him so we would have a fish ticket with the 11th on there. I cannot believe that they did something like this. And you know why they did it? I believe they did it because they want to undermine the marketing associations and everything else, because boats are going to say, why should we belong to a marketing association when he's out there, he's going to pay a higher price to the boats, you know, that aren't a member of the association. We have a lot of issues going on. When we put too much power in one person's hand, this is what happens. And this bill is not against Frank. It's against anybody who wants to amass the type of power that he has.
Ms. Dunn, can you help us understand if these other processors wanted to pay a higher price, how does the dominant player in the market keep that from happening?
How does the dominant player keep it from happening? When you control a huge market share, you could potentially put product on the market. In other words, okay, I agree to pay the fisherman $2 a pound for crab. And so I go out, I buy 100,000 pounds crab for $2 a pound, and somebody else comes in, they're only paying $1.75 a pound for crab. They can put that crab on the market cheaper. They can take my markets away from me by supplying it to my markets for less money than I can. That's how the dominant player can control the market.
Questions?
But my thing is also, this resource belongs to every resident of the state. As a commercial fisherman, it's my job to go out and harvest this resource for the people who do not want to do it themselves, or they don't want to. You know, they don't want to. They don't have the means to do it. Yes, a lot of this product is exported and everything else, but the higher price that we receive as fishermen, the more money is going to stay into our coastal communities and stuff. A 25-cent a pound increase on the price of crab on a 20-million-pound season, that's $5 million more going into our coastal communities. And I believe that it's our job in this state to achieve the highest price we can for our natural resources to the benefit of the people who own them, our residents.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. We appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Senator George.
Real quickly, thank you very much for coming and testifying. In the article that we got from the Oregonian by Jeff Manning, dated March 2, 2011, it talks about at least some of the prices are at the highest prices, record prices paid in 2008. So is there certain things that are going up and certain things that are not? What's that related to? Can you talk about the record prices paid?
We are starting to export more of our product to China and stuff than what we were, so we are starting to achieve, you know, a higher price somewhat. What was your question again?
The Oregonian implies here that you guys have seen high prices and, in fact, the record price paid in 2008. And I was just wondering, compared to what you were saying in some earlier testimony, is that prices have been flatlined. So I'm trying to understand the difference between what the Oregonian is reporting and what you guys are reporting to us.
Well, this is off of the fish tickets that are submitted to the state of Oregon. You know, for every landing that we have, you see a copy of one right here. Every landing we have, it's reported to the state, and there's a poundage paid on it. The price is right on these tickets. That's where this information is coming from. This year we are seeing some higher prices, but that's an average price that we're looking at. That's an average price for the entire season. And traditionally, every year, our price does go up for a while. Then they have openings in Puget Sound later on in the summer. They have Canadian openings. And since it's a global market, our price will go down. And as for this record price, I believe it was, 2001. We're getting more for our crab personally than what we are right now.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. All right, colleagues, and to give I've run into a bit of a time problem here for the other bill, so let me tell those of you who are still in the room waiting for Senate Bill 41 how we'll proceed. We will hear testimony from Attorney General Kroger, Tony Green, and Michael Cron from the Department of Justice, and then we will have people testify who aren't in the Capitol on a regular basis, and those of you who are lobbyists for one group or another that would like to give testimony on Senate Bill 41, we'll roll this over to the next hearing. Assuming we run out of time. So, but this is an important topic. I apologize that this has taken longer than I had anticipated, but we do want to give it a full vetting because it's a very important topic to our economy. So,
that being said, I think Darris Peak is waiting until
we have all the action. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, is this Mr. Peek?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Peek, hi. This is State Senator Chip Shields calling.
Yes,
You are live in the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee, and we are we have a public hearing open for Senate Bill 668. So if you could please identify yourself for the record and give your testimony. And we are running into some time constraints, so if you have provided us with written testimony, please do us the favor and not read it, but summarize the most critical parts if you could. We do have your testimony as part of our record.
My name is Darris Peek. I have a own and operate the Tillamook Bay Boathouse. We process crab, tuna, salmon, and some ground fish. I've been in operation since 2000. I've got 8 employees. I've served as Port Commissioner Garibaldi, and I'm currently chairman of the Oregon Salmon Commission, which I've served for 7 years. We had on my written testimony written up about the crab shipment that we're doing to China at this particular time. I can skip most of that since we have a time constraint. And as a member of the Oregon Crab Advisory Board for 4 years, I'm very excited about this potential of an increased market where we can put more money back into the Oregon crab harvest, back to the boats, the vessels, and the surrounding communities is very important. I am a commercial crabber. I have a small crab boat, the 36-foot fishing vessel April. We fish out of Garibaldi. I do believe that the price of Dungeness crab has been at least 25 cents per pound below where it should have the last 5 years. And from what I observe in the marketplace, there is no doubt that Pacific Seafood is a primary reason for what I believe are fairly low prices paid to the West Coast crabbers. You've got a chart there that shows Emily Dunn's and Emily Dunn's testimony. And it shows the ex-vessel prices since 2006 have been significantly the same, and the rising wholesale prices to processors in the same period are going up. This is a financial stress encountered by many fishing families on Oregon's north coast. I do see a declining level of maintenance throughout the fleet, and if conditions do not improve, I fear that we're going to lose a significant share of our fleet, and it'll gradually be taken over through the acquisition of fishing vessels and by permits by Pacific Seafood. In owning more than 3 commercial permits in any one fishery, it gives a processor an unfair advantage to ex-vessel market and a small port that's extremely important. And I think both the crab and the shrimp fisheries have designated start dates by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and if one processor owns enough fishing vessels, you can send them out at the price set, and you can either fish or you can't. And the processor who goes out early enough in the season will get the largest volumes of both crab and shrimp. And Pacific Fisheries Management Council has done some constraints recently over the whiting fleet and the ground fish, and one of this is limiting the number of permits that any one company could own and control. I think the need for action now is very critical. I participated in the crab negotiations sponsored by the Department of Ag this year, and I can't wait to discuss it. It pretty much, we bent with Pacific Seafood representative refusing to budge above $1.67.5 per pound, and we had no choice. We pretty much ended up sticking with the price proposed by Pacific Seafood. Unlike Pacific Seafood, which has executing a business plan that dominates and buys up fishermen, my vision on this whole thing is one where you can provide free and fair competition, and it results in more processors, more fresh as opposed to frozen product, and more fishing industry jobs in Oregon. In a small town, we definitely need to go after any kind of a job creation we can come up with, which is one reason we're working on this China venture, something to keep the Oregon coast afloat. Before British Columbia rationalized its halibut fishery, everything was caught in as few as 5 days and almost 100% frozen. Since the quota shares have been distributed, this is different. It's been transformed around where we actually have fresh halibut coming out of that area for a longer, greater period of time. The
Oregon crab and shrimp fisheries could follow similar paths with many new niche processors and more value-added products, which back in turn brings more money to our local economy. Senate Bill 668 is very important in this step. One final point we put together here, and it's my own experience with the bullying tactics of Pacific Seafood. Within the first year after we started operations in Garibaldi, I delivered some samples of some nice raw fish fillets that we were processing to the Safeway and Thriftway stores in Tillamook. Less than an hour after getting back to our plant in Garibaldi, I received a phone call from the Pacific Seafood sales rep in charge of selling to those stores who said, if you blanking sell to our stores, we will destroy you. I took him at his word. Instead of trying to sell the stores in Tillamook, I offered to sell them to a supplier to Pacific Seafood, and I never received an order. What I have observed over the 20-some years I've been in this business, if you're a relatively small operator like me and you want to stay in the seafood business, stay off the Pacific Seafood radar. It simply does not benefit my business to piss them off. I'll be happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, committee? All right, let's thank you very much. We appreciate it. We're going to keep moving here. We got somebody from Coos County who's up next, Mr. Bodner.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for providing us with the opportunity to come here today. My name is Steve Bodner. For the last 14 years, I've worked for the Coos Bay Trawler Association, the last 13 of which I've been the executive director. We're an organization of trawl fishermen. We're involved with the pink shrimp fishery, the groundfish fishery, and whiting fishery. My organization supports Bill 668. However, they do not support me being here today. So I am here today as a private citizen. No individual or entity, and especially no seafood processor, should be allowed to own more than 3 commercial crab or shrimp permits because it gives the processor simply too much power to dictate price. I have 2 stories to share from just the last few months, which illustrates how Pacific Seafood abuses its enormous market power to control Oregon fishermen. Just last November, Pacific Seafood representative approached a Coos Bay Trawler member to discuss the formation of a multi-species cooperative that would supply all fish species caught by members' vessels to the Pacific Seafood Charleston plant, which is incorporated under the name of Vanden Pacific Incorporated. Our organization was initially resistant to the idea because we were in the process of trying to form a port-wide cooperative involving all of the trawlers in our home port of Coos Bay, whether they were a member of our organization or not. In November, Pacific Seafood asked for a meeting at the Coos Bay office that was attended by the president and CEO, Frank Dulcich. During the meeting, Mr. Dulcich offered to put shrimp on the table if fishermen would sign the co-op agreement. This meant that the co-op would cover not only the groundfish species now subject to federal individual fish quota allocation to fishermen, but also pink shrimp. Every member of Coos Bay Trawlers Association is involved with the pink shrimp fishery and relies on that fishery for a significant share of its total income during the year. Mr. Dulcich told the fishermen to prepare a fishing plan listing their federal quota amounts of groundfish and also how much shrimp they needed or wanted to land in 2011. Mr. Dulcich said that he would honor the shrimp poundage controlled only by processing capacity and availability of the resource. He also promised to remove his own boats and send them to Alaska to avoid interfering with the rotation for shrimp deliveries in the Charleston plant. He also said that there might be other boats owned by fishermen who had pissed him off or had a reputation for delivering crap that he might cut off. Near the end of the meeting, Mr. Dulcich made it quite clear to my members that if they did not sign the cooperative agreement proposed by Pacific Seafood, shrimp would be off the table. There's no question in my mind or that of my members that Mr. Dulcich was threatening to discontinue his company's willingness to buy shrimp from my members if they did not sign the cooperative agreement.
Mr. Budner, we do have your written testimony in front of you. I'm afraid I'm going to have to use the prerogative of the chair so that we can get on through the rest of the testimony. Could you just summarize your support for the bill and then...
No processors should have so much market power. The Coos Bay Trawlers urge you to pass Senate Bill 668 as a first step towards restoring healthy, fair, competitive competition in the crab and shrimp markets in Oregon. These are public resources that must be managed for the maximum benefit of our citizens.
Great, thank you. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I have to be respectful of everybody's time here that came to testify on the bill.
I get it.
We appreciate your testimony very much. And we got one more, Mr. Hagelin.
Yes, Mike Hagelin, been practicing law in Portland for the last 34 years. I'm presently an elected member of the Oregon Board of Bar Governors. We have a 12 lawyer firm in Portland, do a lot of work in the timber industry. This is almost all for small business, timber industry, maritime industry. We also represent three Indian tribes. Competition law is an area of our expertise. Mike Kelly mentioned we are handling the antitrust case against Pacific Seafood that's pending in the District of Oregon, but I'd like to make three quick points. The first is that it is not, but please don't buy the argument that this bill is somehow linked to the antitrust case. When we were in the midst of our multi-month investigation, talking to fishermen from BC to San Francisco, I learned from a couple of fishermen that we should talk to Wayne Krieger about what he was trying to achieve. Until I had lunch, Mike and I had lunch with Wayne Krieger in Gold Beach about a year ago. I'd never heard of the bill that he had put into the 2009 legislative session. He asked us, described the bill at that lunch, asked us if we thought it would do any good. Based upon what he described to us, we said, yes, it would, and we are here only because here is a coastal legislator who has developed a mechanism to try to address a problem that he has seen throughout his years as a game officer for the Oregon State Police. And it is very much in line with exactly what the federal government has done in whiting and in groundfish within the West Coast waters. Second point I'd like to make is that there is a difference between the Senate Bill 668 language, we're not quite sure exactly why, and House Bill 2184, which is the companion. And we've handed in writing an annotated version of your bill that shows with the single underlined additions just those changes to make it the same as House Bill 2184. We think that's a good idea because it does exempt out the salmon, troll, and gillnet permits, which are about 700 or 800 of the 2,200 total highly competitive fisheries, and there's no need for this legislation as it relates to those. The other addition that's a double underline is our suggestion to make it more like the federal regulation and not allow a loophole where someone who had to sell their permits over three down to three should not be allowed to control them via contract, and we have some very simple control language that accomplishes that, that's very similar to what's in the federal regulations. Lastly, to correct or make a couple counterpoints, there's a reference in some of the opponents' testimony to only owning 6% of the shrimp permits. It's true, it's 6% of the total, but 10 out of 50 active is 20%. And the reality is that shrimp, as Mr. Boardman explains, is where this power has been used in the most extreme manner, sending out company-owned boats to set a price that then the whole fleet must follow. You've heard some pretty compelling testimony. Please read Steve Bodner's testimony, because what he didn't get to say was that Mr. Ernest made multiple phone calls to the president of Coos Bay Trawlers attempting to stop Mr. Bodner from testifying today, and he came here as a private citizen despite the risk to his job. And we would urge you to ask the Attorney General to look into the effort that Pacific Seafood made to influence the testimony that occurred here today by stopping Mr. Bodner from being able to submit his testimony in writing or to speak. I know his testimony was truncated, and that was, I think, perhaps too bad, so please read it. And we would ask you to look at asking the Attorney General to look into this matter. I can tell you that the Attorney General has been investigating it. I think that's why it's a more serious matter. Pacific Seafood and Mr. Ernest know that they're the subject of an ongoing investigation by the Oregon Attorney General, and I was authorized to tell you that the Assistant AG to contact if you wish to get some insight from the Attorney General about their issues with Pacific Seafood. Tim Nord is the person to call at the AG's office. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate
it. Mr. Chair, I have a really quick question.
Senator Bunner,
thank you. Mr. Hagelin. I just want to make sure I understand this. You said that there's a House version that exempts out some highly competitive permits, and that there's, we heard earlier that there are 2,200 permits. So if the highly competitive permits are exempted out, how many would be left?
I believe there's 2,200, and the total for, I've got the figures here, for Oregon troll salmon is 1,092 total, and then you add Columbia River gillnet, it's so 1,400, almost 1,400 of the 2,200 would be exempted out.
Thank you.
Where this really matters is crab and shrimp, which are $40 million resource annually for crab, and about $10 million, I believe, for shrimp.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right. Is anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 668? All right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 668, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 41. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 41. I haven't put my stuff over here. Is establishes deadlines with exceptions by which public bodies must respond to public records requests, sets limits on fees with exceptions which public bodies may charge for responding to public records requests. It establishes the jurisdiction of the Attorney General to hear petitions for review of public records in the custody of elected officials by persons who are denied the right to inspect records. Directs the AG to develop training materials related to public records. Specifies that deadlines apply to local governments beginning on July 1st, 2013. And it has an emergency clause. We do also have the large packet of the Dash 1 amendment, which I believe is what the Attorney General will be speaking to, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and just to give people in the room what my intentions will be under the time constraints that we're under today, since many of us will have to go to different committees, I anticipate hearing from DOJ in full to make sure that we have a full understanding of what the amendments will do, and I'll ask Phil Lemon to come back, Paul Snyder to come back, let's see, John Bartholomew to come back, and any other record? Oh, and Linda Ludwig to come back.
I think they may have this as a group. We may have to here.
Okay. I'll leave it to the League of Oregon City's discretion if they feel their members need to testify this time around or not. That being said, why don't we bring up the panel from the Oregon Department of Justice? Attorney General, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman. I'm John Kroger. I'm the Attorney General of Oregon. With me is Michael Crone, who's the Transparency Counsel at the Department, and Tony Green, who's the Policy and Communications Director. They were the two primary draftspersons of this bill. What you have is actually a bill and a set of amendments, but they're actually an integrated whole. Because of the challenge of drafting this piece of legislation with legislative counsel, the bulk of the bill was ready in time to be dropped and introduced, but the amendments were still being drafted. So the amendments that you have, the Dash 1 amendments, are part and parcel of the entire proposal. As the committee is aware, government transparency is essential in a democracy. It's the only way that citizens can find out what their government is actually doing and to hold their government accountable when their government is doing things that they do not support. In general, in Oregon, our public meetings law is still considered throughout the country a very positive, powerful model of open, transparent government. However, our public records law is not in as good shape. It's really never been substantially reviewed and overhauled since its passage in the 1970s. And to give you a sense of the impact, when the public records law was originally drafted, there were roughly 50 exemptions, 50 categories of records that were not subject to public disclosure. When I came into office and became responsible for public records in the state system, I asked how many exemptions we had. The answer was approximately 200. The fact that we didn't know the exact number troubled me. We started counting. We've identified over 400 exemptions that have piled up over the years. And that movement from 55 types of records that are not subject to disclosure to over 400 represents what's happened over the years, a significant reduction in transparency of Oregon state government. The bill represents the end product of about a year and a half of work. We held public meetings throughout the state in every single region. They were very well attended, both by experts who work in the field, as well as lots of citizen activists, from people who were trying to understand better what their school boards were doing to people who had questions or ongoing issues with state government. So we heard from hundreds of citizens. We've also held dozens of meetings with every conceivable interest group to get their input on the bill. The bill really does six important things, and each six of these are analytically independent and legally independent, meaning if you like four of the ideas but you don't like two of them, you can strike down two of them and you won't affect the overall structure of the bill. So it's not as if this is an all-or-nothing proposition, and so I just wanted to flag that up front. First of all, we've put all of the exemptions in Oregon law for the first time in one place in the statute book and organized them under 10 categories. What we discovered was that all of the exemptions to the public records law were literally littered throughout all the various different chapters of the Oregon revised statutes. And this had two negative consequences. First, citizens had a very difficult time discovering whether a certain type of record was or was not exempt from disclosure. And second, it dries up legal bills, because the only way to get a right answer is to have counsel go through all the statutes and do legal searches trying to figure things out. So what we've done for the first time is moved all the exemptions into one place in the statute book and organize them by category. So if you have, for instance, a medical records issue, all the medical records exemptions are there in one easy category so you can find them. And I have to say, all of us believe very much that if the bill only did that, it would be very worthwhile doing. This really will bring down legal bills and make government transparent on its own. Second, we've identified 100 of the exemptions for elimination. And the exemptions that we've identified for elimination really fall into a couple different categories. Some of them are really just duplicates. For example, in some areas we found that there were three exemptions dealing with the same subject, one narrow, one medium, and one broad. And this causes an immense amount of confusion. They're in different parts of the statute book. So we've tried to eliminate every duplicate so that there's one exemption covering a certain type of record. Second, we've identified a certain number of exemptions that should, in our opinion, be eliminated in order to bring greater transparency in substantive areas of law. And those are the exemption eliminations are what's in the Dash 1 amendments. To give you a couple examples, if you have an auto accident out on the road, that accident report is a public record and you can get information about it. But if that happens on a river, it's a marine accident, and those are not open to the public. And we were able to determine absolutely no public justification for why those marine accidents wouldn't be disclosable. We have revised the exemptions that apply to the Treasury so that it will require disclosure of public records showing expenditures by private investment vehicles on behalf of the state treasury or a state treasury employee. This was done in conjunction with the treasurer, and we'll try to bring a little bit more transparency into that area. A third example, certain personnel discipline records of managers, which are not currently subject to disclosure, would be subject to disclosure under this bill. That means that if a manager in state government was engaged in financial improprieties on the job or sexual harassment on the job, those disciplinary records would be subject to disclosure for the first time. This is very important because unfortunately we have a track record in Oregon of having some managers with significant managerial trouble either remaining in state government or being eliminated in one job and resurfacing in another job. And I believe if there were greater transparency in this area, we would have better control over that problem. Third, Oregon currently has no deadlines by which government must comply with a public records request from the public. The records are supposed to be submitted when it is reasonable for government to do so, and this causes an immense amount of heartache. An example we've heard frequently in our public meetings around the state, an individual would request information from their school board in preparation for a school board meeting, and then had no way of knowing whether they'd get the records in time. They'd have to keep checking back with government, and often the deadline would pass and they would not get the records in time for the meetings. Many, many states have deadlines that apply, and we have put deadlines for the first time in this proposal. Government entities would have 10 days working days automatically to respond to a request, with the ability to extend that automatically to 20 days if they needed additional time, and then the ability to appeal if they're in state government to the attorney general, county or local government to the district attorney, to order to get an extension, which might be necessary if it was a particularly voluminous request or a complex request. Deadlines are something that are in place in many other states. The states that have them often have much more stringent ones than we have proposed. I can tell you that this is very feasible. Independently at the Department of Justice, put deadlines on our public records requests that we receive in January of 2010, and we have received 533 public record requests since that time, so we receive a very large volume. They tend to be very complicated just because we're a legal agency, and we're averaging 7 actual days, not working days, but 7 actual days responding to those requests. So we're the notion that you have 20 business days to comply with these requests is eminently doable. We were able to meet those deadlines with absolutely hiring of no additional staff. I'm quite confident this can be done without any fiscal impact. Fourth, we put in a fiscal protection to guard against repeat players who are making requests of agencies but not paying for them. And the requirement is very simple. If you have made a public records request and you owe money to a governmental entity and you have not paid that money to pay for your last request, they are not required to process your next request for information until you've paid off the cost for the last one. This is an attempt to deal with a problem that has been reported, I think, most frequently at lower level governmental entities, at the local level, where people would keep making requests even though they had not paid for the last one. Fifth, we've come up with a uniform method of calculating cost recovery for government and placed a cap on cost recovery for government. The goal here was to solve a problem, again, we heard repeatedly in the public testimony, of agencies or governmental entities inflating an estimate of how much records would cost to process in order to chill advocates, whether in the media or private individuals, from requesting those documents. And so what we've calculated is a cap of 3 times the minimum wage per hour, so approximately $25 per hour the government could charge, as well as a cap on supplies that would be the actual cost of supplies that are needed in order to meet the request. I should say this is, I want to highlight this, of all the proposals in the bill, this is the one that will have a fiscal impact because we are effectively limiting the amount of cost recovery that can be done. And so I just want the committee to be aware of that. Of the things in this bill, I'm very conscious of our fiscal situation in state government, and I just want to flag that for the committee, that this is the one that's likely to draw some significant fiscal impact, and we don't have that calculated yet, but that is the case. Sixth, we've got a requirement that the Department of Justice provide free training on transparency laws to governmental entities around the state. And the reason for this is very simple. We discovered that one of the real challenges that smaller governmental entities face is that you often have brand new elected officials, a city councilman or an education board person, and they're now required to follow these laws, but they may not have any familiarity with them, and it's difficult to get the training. I put this in the statute, even though we can do this on our own, I put it in the statute because I want the Department of Justice to be bound to do this. I think this is really important. A lot of the disputes that we heard about were disputes that were driven by misunderstanding, often in government, about what the law does or does not require. And so I think the education of public officials is very important. Finally, I should note that when we drafted this bill, from the very outset, we had put in an exemption exempting county, city, and local governmental entities from falling under the deadline and cost calculation caps for 2 years after the passage of the bill. And the goal was really twofold. One, the smaller governmental entities, I know, are facing a lot of challenges due to the recession, and we didn't want to throw a curveball their direction during the heart of the recession. I also wanted an opportunity to show at the state level that this was eminently feasible and that it could be done. And so this will give us an opportunity, should the bill pass in its current form, to use those 2 years of state government as, if you will, the guinea pig to show that this works. If there are problems that need to be changed, they could be changed. And if the cities and counties have built a good record that these requirements should not apply to them, they'll have a full legislative session to bring those concerns forward. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I've brought the brain trust here as well if there are questions that are beyond my capability. Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you. You want to respond to ODOT, who doesn't like it?
Chairman Shields, Senator Boquist, I've not seen their comments yet, so I would be happy to respond to a summary.
Specifically, it says ODOT must charge actual costs, and so the Constitution will protect them. They can charge whatever they want to. They'd have to have more required staff so that they could, you know, manage to do it on a day-to-day basis and continue to hide what they're doing. Which they did before this committee previously.
Where's that? I missed that statement there.
Mr. Chairman, I think as I mentioned when I testified, I mean the part of the bill, I'm very much not trying to hide the ball. The cost recovery provisions would have government recovering less money when they're doing these. And that does have some fiscal impact on governmental entities. The thing I will tell you quite simply, not just with respect to ODOT, this bill is not a consensus bill. I mean, quite honestly, really very few people in government want to change the current rules. I mean, this really is one of those situations where citizens, I think, want a very transparent government, and government more or less believes that transparency is a hassle. And I say that someone who spent most of his career in government. It is not the case that we went and got every government agency at every level to support this bill. Quite frankly, because if we had, it would be watered down so greatly that it would do much less good. It does represent a choice of how much transparency this body believes we ought to have. And so I'm not surprised. I know I have great respect for the counties and cities. I know they have reservations about this bill, and you should take all those concerns very seriously. But, you know, we've worked as much as we could, and we've consulted a lot, but at the end of the day, we're either going to have rules that more closely approximate the best rules in place in other states, or we will not.
Senator George.
Yeah, real quickly, Mr. Attorney General, thank you very much for coming by my office to discuss the bill with me. I thought about it after we talked about it. The question I have for, I guess, the panelists is that I don't have any problem putting the cost limitation on state government because that's something we control. I'm a little nervous about putting the same $25 per hour or three times minimum wage on local governments. And that would be my big concern with the bill. Actually, of all the things you've discussed, I know that's the one you're most flexible on. I don't necessarily want you to respond to that right now, but I would like to see perhaps some kind of exemption on local government's recovery of actual costs. I don't have a problem putting a hard and fast rule on the state because that's what we do. So just kind of so you know where I'm headed after conversation, that flexibility would make me feel a little more comfortable with the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, I respect that view very much. Obviously, the bill would not apply to the local governmental entities for 2 years in another legislative session. I'm of mixed minds. I share your concern. I mean, I think the that's not a frivolous concern by any means. I mean, I respect that. I recognize that's the heart of concern of some of the local governmental bodies. I guess what I would say in response, this provision came out of the hearings we held. This was not an original part of our bill. And a lot of the most compelling stories we heard about concerns about cost estimates were at the local governmental level. It seemed that the passions on these issues grew stronger the more immediately local the governmental body was. I mean, I disputes in front of school boards about public records took more of our public hearing time than I would have imagined when we set out. So this was crafted to deal in part with a problem that was really identified as happening more at the local level than it was at the state governmental level. That said, as I've indicated to you and other members of the committee, my goal is I think we have a lot of very important reforms here, and I do not want concerns on the committee of one particular part of this bill to sink the overall effort.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Attorney General, for your testimony. I'm hoping to get, maybe not at this time, but maybe a little more details about the difference between what the cost would be under existing law and under the new proposal. Because all I know now is that it's going to be, they'll get more, they'll pay more, and I need to know what that difference is. So more information would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, Michael Crone is really the expert on this, and I think he'd be the best to deal with the cost question of the cap fee for recovery.
Sure. Chair Shields and Senator Bonamici, thanks for having me. Well, current law basically says that they can charge the actual cost of providing the records, which has been interpreted to mean the actual cost of the actual staff that are assigned to do the work. And the result, of course, then, is that you can effectively control the cost of providing public records to someone by assigning it to personnel within your public body. A kind of high-profile example, the Court of Appeals heard a case where some really high-level professionals were assigned to do some review and redaction, and the information that was primarily being sought for redaction was simply the names of certain individuals, and the people assigned to do this task were licensed professionals, and were, I mean, the fee was, as a consequence, something on the order of $250,000. Court of Appeals took a look at that and said, that seems like you might be able to figure out a better way of doing this. They didn't resolve the substance of that dispute because they found that the lower court had applied an incorrect standard in assessing the overall issue, but the example is out there, and there are other examples that we heard as well of people basically assigning high-cost staff to do low-cost work.
Thank you.
Senator Bocas.
Just a quick takeaway for later. Could you provide us a list of the 100 exemptions you're going to eliminate? And probably a simple read someplace.
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I'm not going to eliminate anything. I hope this committee does.
You're proposing to eliminate.
I'm certainly proposing. Yes, we will prepare a summary for all the members of the committee with a simple list.
That'd be great. And you can get it to Patrick, and he can distribute it.
Three of them.
All right. So I'll leave it to your prerogative to go on with your testimony, Tony, or...
I think we're set, Mr. Chairman, and unless there are further questions.
That's it. Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Could we bring up, let's see, Mike O'Brien? Stephanie Stewart? Oops, sorry. And Dwayne Bosworth. Welcome to the committee. Jump right in.
Senator and members of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity. I am Mike O'Brien.
publisher of Capital Press, the regional agriculture weekly newspaper owned by the East Oregonian Publishing Company. I'm here today to speak on behalf of our company's two daily newspapers and four weekly newspapers in Oregon. We support Attorney General Kroger's proposal to strengthen and clarify Oregon's public records law. I will give the committee examples of how our newspapers in Pendleton, Astoria, and John Day use the public records statute. The Daily Historian files public records requests about 8 times a year. Our reporters take this action while reporting the inner workings of public agencies and their policymaking of the spending of tax dollars. Just 1 month ago, the local bus district, the Sunset Empire Transportation District, put its executive director on paid leave, refusing to accept her resignation, but would not say why. The newspaper obtained her performance reviews dating back 8 years in an effort to inform the public. In 2008, the Daily Historian sought details of contact between the Clatsop County Commissioner and the County Planning Department over a prolonged period after reports of using inappropriate contact and pressure. After details were publicized by the newspaper, voters recalled the County Commissioner. In Grant County, the Blue Mountain Eagle routinely files public records requests with small agencies where officials may have only infrequent experience with the public records law. In some cases, the requests essentially paper the file for the public officials who aren't comfortable releasing information and don't have an attorney standing by to answer their questions. Here's a case in point. The Eagle in 2009 made a formal request to the city of Prairie City for a tort claim notice filed by the former police chief who had been let go by the city. The city recorder was aware that there was intense public interest in this issue, but she wanted a request on paper before releasing the document. The newspaper provided it and received the record without problem. However, without a strong law to protect public interest, we believe there would be constant battles over even routine records that are patently public. The East Oregonian Pendleton uses the public records law 10 to 12 times a year. In 2010, a significant case involved the EEO's request for a 911 recording and subsequent police radio discussions concerning the sighting of a gun at a school just outside of Hermiston city limits. The recordings revealed confusion from Umatilla County dispatchers about where the school was and revealed the county had no one available to respond to the possible crisis. The conversations also showed the county turned down a request from Hermiston Police to respond to the scene. The Education Service District for Umatilla and Morrow Counties is working with these police agencies to come up with a better response plan for any future crisis. Finally, my last example comes from Hermiston. As we speak, the Hermiston Herald is dealing with the city's police department over the fee it accesses the press and public for request simply to view the public record. I appreciate having this opportunity to speak on behalf of the East Oregonian Publishing Company, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Stewart.
Chair Shields and committee members, my name is Stephanie Stewart. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm the chair of the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association's Land Use Committee, located in Southeast Portland, which is a part of Portland's network of 95 recognized organizations established to act as liaisons between city government and community citizens. I'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity today, and I support SB 41. I don't know a single person that isn't surprised and disappointed by public records policies once they actually try to access a public record. This is a bad sign. Citizens have a vision for how their government functions, and current policies don't live up to their expectations. An incident I had last year trying to access a public record inspired me to take a closer look at policies. Public records policy in Oregon needs reform. It does not reflect our values, and it's out of line with our peers. The changes proposed in this bill are meaningful and an excellent step in the right direction. My personal experience leaves me to feel that we actually need more changes than what this bill is prepared to do, but this is a solid beginning. And I'd like to speak to a few of the points brought up already in this hearing. As to the limit for labor charges and your questions as to how that might impact folks at the local level. I can cite, maybe somewhat for some insight here, a financial example. I have reviewed what the Portland Water Bureau has published for their own audit of what public records requests cost them in a year. So in a one-year period that they where they did their audit, they said that all public records requests for every type for the Water Bureau cost them $37,000, and that counted as staff time and copying materials and everything. And this bureau has a $600,000 a year budget for public involvement alone. So $37,000 compared to their $600,000 a year public involvement budget, I believe, is about 6% of that budget. So if you were to completely wipe out all labor fees for public records requests at the local level, you could possibly see an impact something like 6% of their public involvement budgets, but that's not even what's being proposed today. Limiting the labor charges to $15 an hour actually brings us more in line with what I believe are our peers, the states around us. In Washington, they charge $15 an hour flat rate for labor, and in California, I believe they don't charge anything for labor. Limiting the labor charges does a couple of things that are very beneficial. It makes the process more predictable for citizens, more affordable, of course, for citizens also, but then it also makes it a more streamlined process on the government side, making it easier for them to calculate the charges that are incurred. And one of the records requests I issued last year, you could tell from the bill that it was a bit complicated to levy the charges against me because of all the different people they had to calculate at different rates that were involved in the records request, and that seems senseless to me. Speaking to inflated charges and the idea that hopefully limiting labor charges might help limit some of the inflated fees that are being levied against citizens who are trying to get access to information, I'd cite for you, and I could cite a number of cases, but one particularly egregious case that happened last year was a colleague of mine made a request to see from one of the city bureaus to see a particular set of plans for a 4 or 5 year period related to the water reservoirs in Portland, Oregon, and my neighborhood. And he made the offer that he would go in person and sit, you know, volunteer a week of his time to sit downtown and do whatever he needed to do to be in the library to actually read the documents. And he was still issued a bill prior to anything beginning of $700,000 for his request. Now, I can't think of how $700,000 could ever be justified, even if the Water Bureau was going to hire a full-time staff person for a year and buy the man his own copy machine, it would come in less than $100,000 for a record request. So inflated requests happen, and if limiting labor charges will help curb this, then this needs to happen. I personally would like to see this bill go into effect sooner than 2 years at the local level, because folks at the local level need it to happen sooner. And I hope you'll start with this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Turner, for your testimony. Mr. Bosworth.
Thank you, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Dwayne Bosworth. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I represent newspapers throughout the state, along with a number of television stations and radio stations. I have served on the board of Open Oregon for many years. That's an amalgam of government and media and citizens dedicated to transparency in government. And I'm the author, among other publications, of the chapters for the National Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and in particular publications concerning access to government, and that has made me familiar with what the 50 states are doing. I had the privilege this last year of traveling around the state and serving as the facilitator for the series of public meetings and public testimony that you heard Attorney General Kroger discuss. And I heard the testimony there and the needs both of citizens and of the media for increased transparency. I testify today on my own behalf. In the interest of time, I will make my remarks quite brief. I would like to emphasize that this bill, for the first time, does put a period of time, a number of days, into Oregon legislation. I would emphasize that it continues to have the phrase "as soon as practicable," because I think in many instances that may well be shorter than the time that is permitted. But this is a great first step. It is in league with what many states around the nation have done, and some of them, in fact, have insisted on periods as short as 3 and 4 days for first responses. I think this is, again, something that is very needed, and it's in league with what we heard as we traveled around the state. The second point is that the attempt here to limit the costs that would be charged to those asking for public records is, again, I think, a very good step. I think we just heard $15 thrown out, but I think it's more like $25, if I'm not mistaken. I would testify simply that this is frequently a problem. In times of stress, this is not to characterize all responses on behalf of government, but in times of stress, you do find any number of things that can happen that may even intentionally be running up the costs of response. I think that this measure will, in fact, ensure that the proper staff person is handling the request and that there isn't an artificial inflation. And again, I would say that this is in league with, frankly, not even the best practices around the nation. There are a number of states that, in fact, deem that public records are, in fact, the property of the public, and it is simply a cost of government to provide them. I don't think we're prepared to go that far today, but this measure, which at least limits the costs of staff, is, I think, a great step. Thank you.
Great testimony. Questions? All right, we'll go on to the next panel, and thank you for hanging in there, colleagues. I do understand that if you need to go to other appointments, feel free.
There's going to be a committee in here at 3 also.
So. Yeah, we're going to have to vacate the room at 3. Can we bring up the panel for the League of Oregon Cities? Ms. Ludwig, Krager, and Johnson. And if I'm reading the list correct, everyone else who is has signed up to testify is either employed to be here or is in the building quite frequently. So I think after this panel, we're going to have to move on. Is that incorrect?
That's incorrect.
Are you Ms. Campbell?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely stay for your testimony. You'll be next. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig of Oregon Cities, and I will absolutely follow the Chair's directive and hold our testimony from the League until the next hearing. I want to say, though, we do believe in transparency very, very, very much, particularly with regard to public records requests. We have some concerns about the bill, and here today to talk to you are a couple of women from... we have some concerns with how the bill's play out at the local level. And with me today are a couple of women from the Oregon Association of Municipal Recorders, Carol Krager. She's the legislative committee chair. She's also the deputy recorder at the city of Tigard, and Karen Johnson, who is the president of the Recorders Association. She's the recorder in the city of Independence.
Welcome to the committee.
Let me go. Okay, so we're representing OAMR. I don't know if you're aware, but city recorders are on the front line for...
And could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Carol Krager. I'm the legislative committee chair from OAMR. We're on the front line for records requests in cities. And that's one thing to keep in mind is Oregon has a lot of cities, a lot of different sized cities. Portland may have many people that could respond to a request. Some cities, the city recorder is actually also the finance officer. Sometimes they're the HR department, I believe Karen is. We have other duties going on, but public records is one of our most important. When we first saw this bill, I asked our members, how do you feel about this? We were a little surprised. Because most of our requests can be accomplished within the 10-day time period. because we do hold, it is important to us, and most of them are fairly easy to find. However, we do have requests, and if you'd like examples, we have them, of the more complex or lengthy requests that, frankly, we would have to go beyond even the 20 days offered here, which is fine, but what we'd like to do is our current practice, which is talk to the requester and work out an agreeable deadline. I don't know why we have to have the DA in the little triangle here, but what has worked well for us is communicating with the requester and working out a deadline that works for both of us. Often they don't understand. We may have part of our records electronically. Those are very easy to obtain. We could do that almost immediately, give them a DVD. If they want to go back perhaps to 1983 and see all land use actions or something, that involves looking at microfilm. And depending on what other records appointments we have set up, they may have to wait a little while until we can search through the film. We also have records in boxes off-site. But what I found is a conversation with the requester, usually they say, oh, okay, well, I'm kind of in a hurry, but, you know, we work it out. And I'd like that language to remain, that reasonable as soon as practicable. Also, on the fee, I think there was an assumption that the person filling the request, this is what we were told in a walkthrough of 3319, is a lower-level clerk. And that might be in some state agencies, but in cities, it's your city recorder. Sometimes it's the city manager. Sometimes it's public works director. The smaller cities told me they want to be reimbursed. They're strapped economically. Limiting it is going to hurt some people. Are we supposed to start thinking ahead and budgeting for that? We certainly can't hire people, so you've got this 10-day deadline boxing us in, and then you're taking away getting reimbursed for the time where we're being taken off everything else. I do want to say, though, that we are committed to government transparency, and we get to things as fast as we can. We would just like the chance to work it out with our customers.
Thank you.
Senator Shields and the committee, my name is Karen Johnson. I'm the city recorder for the City of Independence, Oregon. Thank you for letting me come today. As my friend Carol said, we do support government transparency. As a city recorder, we, and at the local level, we are probably the ones who work with our citizens more directly than any other form of government. We are the people who, you know, go to church with them. We see them at ball games. We know each other. We work together. And especially in a smaller city where I am the records department, I am also the HR department, things can be a little bit problematic if you have a very, very large record request. How I do it at my city, and I think is how it happens at the majority of cities, is if somebody comes in requesting a public record, I'll ask them what they are after. And most likely it's something I can give them right away, and I will give it to them right away. I don't make them fill out a form. I don't make them jump through hoops. I say, okay, you need to have a copy of an ordinance. Great, here it is. What's more challenging is if we have the very, very voluminous request, and I'm the person who would fill the request. What happens if I'm sick? I'm on vacation. There's all sorts of other things. What if I am, as the HR director, I get a gender harassment complaint. I am obligated to investigate that. So what do I put on hold first? That or the records request? We do our best. We work with our requesters. So when I do get a voluminous request like I just did in January, somebody requested all copies of all building permit files for the past 3 years, and that was an awful lot of paper. We don't have anything digitized at all. It's all paper, and it would take about 10 to 15 hours for me to make all of those copies, and the requester said, oh, I didn't realize it would take that long, plus you have the fact that I can't devote all 8 hours of the day to just that request, so it would take several weeks to to complete the request. And he said, oh, I didn't realize it would take that long. Can you just send me a log of all of the permits? I said, great, I can just email that to you. And he was happy with that. So it's, I think there's a point where we need to be able to look at compromise before you set hard and fast deadlines. I like the thought of the compiling all of the exemptions in one spot. That would make life so much easier. Thank you very much. However, there are so many other things in the bill that would be problematic for small cities. The three times the minimum wage, for me, it's, as I said, I'm the only person. It's not like we are trying to inflate a request. I am the only person who would do that, and my wages and benefits are much higher than three times that the minimum wage. If I'm out of the office, it would be either the city manager or a department head who would have to fulfill the request if I'm out of the office for an extended time. And so obviously the cost would be even greater. So in these times, we're letting go of staff and we can't increase staff. If we get a request that's pertains to, say, emails, we would have to hire an IT consultant, and I'm guessing that they charge more than $25 an hour. So it would be very costly for cities with that kind of a restriction.
Okay. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Ms. Campbell, if you could please come forward.
Hi, I'm Allison Keene Campbell, acting Metro attorney. Hello, Senator Monroe, former Metro Councilor Monroe. I realize I'm between you and the next meeting, so I will be quick. I want to say that I strongly support the idea of open government, transparency. Most of us who work in government did so not for the money and not for the great offices, but because we believe in what we are working on. And I do appreciate the AG's attempts to eliminate the redundancies and to help overall transparency. And I'm also aghast when I hear about the black holes of public records requests. At Metro, in the 15 years I've been there, we have never been challenged on a public records request, mainly because we have internal rules about them. My sole beef with the new changes, and I think that they can be worked out, I'd be willing to sit on a committee to work them out, is this one-size-fits-all time limit. The people who just testified gave you some good examples. Probably about 20% of our records requests can be fulfilled in one day. They want one document, we can get it for them. But most of our records requests are complex, they're valid, they're not easily narrowed, and they take the time of attorneys, of the numerous staff, and of the agency in responding properly. And a 20-day deadline is just going, what that will do is put the public records request have to be on the top of the list. On the top of my day would have to be figuring out how to respond to a public records request. And you say, well, why would you give it to an attorney? Why wouldn't you let just a low-level administrative staff do it? Well, because of the exemptions that govern all of the legal aspects of it. An attorney is often the central point. I'll wrap up. Some of our requests will definitely take more than 20 days. I don't have a clear answer for how to deal with those local governments who don't respond at all, and I would be willing to sit with the AG and a committee to try to work that out. However, the remedy of going to the DA is not really a remedy. That's another unfunded mandate. I don't think that there's money in this bill to provide the DA with this additional time to hear all of our requests. I can never even get the DA on the phone if I have a true substantive question about a public records exemption. So they have one DA who's assigned to it, just like we don't have an FTE to assign for public records requests. So I ask you to consider we lowly public agencies who don't have all of the resources of the state really there's just a few of us trying to respond to these things and doing it well. We need more than a one-size-fits-all time limit.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Campbell. I had to
rush you
along.
We're going to carry this over.
We are. We're going to carry this bill over. We're going to do the rest of the testimony on this at the latter portion of the hearing on Wednesday.
So we need to carry 751 over?
We're also going to carry over Senate Bill 751 for work session.
Correct.
So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 41, and this meeting is adjourned.